Today on All the Way Authentic, I interview Eddie Pate and Jonathan Stutz, who wrote Daily Practices of Inclusive Leaders. This is a must-have book for anyone who considers themselves or is in the role of leadership at their business or at their company or at their organization. Jonathan and Eddie will be at a book talk and a book signing on May 29th at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time at Third Place Books in Lake Forest Park. Now here's that interview with Eddie Pate and Jonathan Stutz talking about their wonderful new book, Daily Practices of Inclusive Leaders, here on All the Way Authentic. I'm your host, Kevin P. Henry.
Yeah, so I figured that we would start off, you know, a little bit at the beginning, I guess, in the sense that you have this book that's coming out in, I believe, is it May?
Yeah, May 28th.
May 28th, yep. Says Jonathan Stutz, one of our guests. And I just want to know kind of how it started. You know, was it like, Jonathan, you were sleeping soundly one night and you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, you fell out of bed with a cold sweat saying, I got to call Eddie and we got to write this book. So
it was just about that way.
Yeah, from there.
Jonathan. I mean, I remember exactly where I was standing and, you know, going back a ways even before, you know, we decided to write together. I had had ambitions to write a book for years and had one from my Microsoft years that I still want to get done. But this one was really, for me, based upon a master's thesis that I wrote in 2013 on leadership. And it was this idea that leaders have heart, they have courage, they have wisdom, and they have a vision for the larger group to get to a certain place. And so that was the master's thesis when, and it was called The Yellow Brick Road of Leadership. And so I felt that had the bones for a book. And then when Eddie and I fast forward, you know, started working for him at Amazon in, you know, 2017, of that evolved where we started working with his 2IL model, which is the Insights of Inclusive Leadership. And that seemed to be a great marriage of the concepts, because the 2IL model is all about, you know, wisdom, which is this knowledge with experience kind of strengthened into wisdom, and how we think about diversity from the standpoint of these seven insights that Eddie will talk about maybe later. But so that was kind of, and then we would go on trips. We went to India, we went to other countries, and we talked about this idea of maybe writing together. We both knew we wanted to write once we soft retired from corporate life. And so fast forward to about a year and a half ago, it was early December, and I was really languishing with getting myself disciplined to sit down and write. It just was too many fun things and other things to do. So I called him up and I said, I'm feeling this. And I used the word languishing, I remember. And Eddie said, you know what? I'm feeling the exact same way. And I said, what if we, just like you do in a work environment, you hold each other accountable. You set dates, you know, for things done. You set, you know, you have meetings on a regular, you know, weekly or biweekly basis to, you know, go through and achieve certain milestones. So we thought we could do it that way and it would help us both. But then we got on the phone with our friend Bill Price, and because Bill's written three books, he was the first vice president of customer service at Amazon. He's a world expert in the space on customer service. And we asked him what he thought about the idea of writing the book with somebody. And, you know, he gave us a lot of advice and counsel on what to do, what not to do, and how to approach it. And then we pitched our idea to him of what we wanted to write about. He thought it was a great idea. And he wanted to introduce us to a guy by the name of Neil Mallett at Barrett Kohler, which ended up being our publisher. And so he made the introduction. Eddie and I made the pitch. It took 4 months from the time we initially pitched it till we honed our proposal. It ended up being like 27 pages. And then their organization, a very democratic organization, they literally vote and they all signed off on it. They were ready to go with this Daily Practices of Inclusive Leaders. And that's how I remember it. It kind of evolved. And then, you know, they put us on a schedule. We were off and running, and they connected us with a writing coach. And anyway, Eddie, you know, fill in the blanks there. I'm sure I missed a few things, but and your perspective, too. It's really important.
Oh, no, I appreciate it, Jonathan. Yeah, I think you
you covered it really well. And the only thing I would, I think the only thing I would add to this is I was the same way for many years. I had really had this aspiration to write a book and feel like I still have more books in me that I eventually want to write. And it was just this, like this confluence of really cool things happening. We both retiring about the same time, BK Publishing becoming a reality. And it is really hard to find and land a great publisher and get through that whole process. And so it was just this confluence of wonderful, things hitting all at the same time that led us to being able to now have a book that's going to be published May 28th, right? So that's pretty exciting. So that, yeah, I think Jonathan, you covered it. I think you covered it well.
And so how does or how did the process work? Was it like you're at two separate laptops at different times, and then Jonathan writes a little bit, then you write a little bit, take me through that whole process.
Sure. This is Eddie speaking, and then Jonathan, jump in on this as well. So we both got very disciplined because now we had a publisher and we had a mission and timing, right? So we got very, very disciplined about when we both would write. I was a very early morning writer. Jonathan would write after he'd come back from running, and so we had designated times. But we ended up being very, very fortunate that BK Publishers recommended a writing coach for us, Daniel Goodman. And Daniel Goodman is incredible. And so we had a writing coach who helped the process immensely from being our project manager to, most importantly, in my mind, he took Jonathan's voice, Eddie Pate's voice, and created one voice from them. And that was the most difficult piece of it, is we write differently. And we both understand inclusion, diversity, and equity. Jonathan has a strong leadership background and some and work across cultures. I have very strong inclusion, diversity, and equity structure, strategy, leadership background. And Danielle was able to merge those processes together and our voices together so that it comes out that where it's one coherent, inspirational book that's come out of two separate voices. And really, that was the process for us. And we took our proposal and we literally divided it in half. And I took half the chapters, Jonathan took half the chapters. I would write my first draft of that, hand it over to Jonathan to weigh in and give feedback, and then we'd hand it to Danielle to edit it, restructure it, move it around to make sure the voices sound the same. And that's what we did, and for the bulk of the chapters. And then in the part of the book, Kevin, where we talk about the daily practices that are aligned to the life cycle of an employee, we kind of picked and choose kind of the kind of the different types of daily practices that we had passion about or wanting to write about. Jonathan has strong passion about diversity one-on-ones with, discussions and dialogue. I have a lot of passion around the pause button and diversity nudges. So we picked those different daily practices to kind of write, and then did the same thing, swapped them, edit them, gave suggestions for them, and then let Danielle do the primary editing and any kind of shifting of thought. And that's how the process worked right to the very end. And then the last part I'll say, and then step aside for Jonathan to speak too, is what we both have learned in this process. It's not just the writing of the book. There's so much more that goes into creating this thing you hold in your hand that's a book that you can show people, right? From the who's going to do what endorsements, who's going to connect with people who are going to write the endorsements, who what do we want on the back cover, what do we want our bios to look like, how are we going to arrange for pictures, right? Who's going to take care of the getting the rights to the comic strip that we want to put in the book. So all these little details surfaced, and what I think we did really well is divide those up, I think, very fairly and equitably, and helped each other in those processes. And so from that standpoint, it was pretty remarkable. So that's a long-winded response, Kevin, to the what was the process. And Jonathan, I'll step aside and see. I'm clearly probably missed a whole bunch of stuff that you can jump in on.
Yeah, this is Jonathan. I think you also did really well in covering you know, kind of the landscape. For me, I think it was just kind of popping up, you know, to 30,000 feet. It was just a whole lot more work than any of us ever imagined to do it right. And like Eddie was saying, just a million details that needed to be addressed, and it became a full-time job for these two guys that are soft retired. You know, it was a lot of work, and it was worth it for sure. And there were challenges all along the way, just like any project that is highly complex and difficult and super challenging. But then the reward becomes, you know, all the better and all the greater. And so we're front loading it with a lot of work. We built a website out. We just launched it today called inclusivepebbles.com. Check it out. And there's some really unique things that have been done there. Eddie had this great idea of recognizing that, yeah, we did a lot of work to write the book and our names are on the front of the book. But there's a whole team of people like Danielle behind us, right, that helped us and supported us and were there as advisors and contributors, whether it was the photographer or the illustrator or the editor or the person who designed the cover, or, you know, all these people throughout the process were part of it. So one of the tabs on the website is called It Takes a Village. And it goes through and has a picture of each person, a link to their website and their LinkedIn if they have that. And so you can get to know these folks. And one of the things that was really important to us, and we talk about intentionality in the book, is we were super focused on making sure that we walk the talk, that we had a really diverse community of people supporting and around us. So, for example, when we went to hire a publicist to help us promote and market the book, we really wanted to look at Black and Brown owned businesses. Well, there just doesn't happen to be a lot of them in that space. So we really kind of stretched our publisher and asked them for recommendations. And we ended up interviewing this woman, Dawn Michelle Hardy, with the Literary Lobbyist. And we loved her. She was so passionate and so enthusiastic and so knowledgeable and experienced as both a publicist and an agent. So we've hired her, and she's working with us. She's a Black woman out of Charlotte, North Carolina. So all throughout that, that's just one example, but throughout, whether it's the endorsements or whether it's the videographer, who's a great guy, you know, or the people we actually have profiles of leaders in the book instead of not just the, you know, talking about what you do and how you do it, but we actually profile five different leaders in the first five chapters that emulate the characteristics of what that chapter is talking about. So you get to know some real world people that are living this and like I said, walking the talk. So lots of little like things along the way that were both complex, difficult, challenging, but also some really fun, unique things we were able to do.
Well, let's dig into the book, because you mentioned daily practices. And, you know, we've talked before where I think we all agreed that it's not just a check the box thing. Like, I can just, you know, go to this 3-hour webinar or whatever, and now I'm a leader and I'm going to lead my business or my organization or whatever. That it's like a mind shift. It's a lifestyle. You know, it's like, I think I made the comparison to like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who works out every day. You know, it's not like he works out for a couple of weeks and then he takes 6 months off and then comes back. So talk about that and why that's so important. You know, just talk about those key ingredients that really make an effective leader. Start with you, Jonathan.
Sure. Yeah. It is this idea that you're talking about. This isn't just something where you go to a class and you're vaccinated and now you're an inclusive leader, right? It's more like where you need that, you know, you need to be doing this stuff every day. I run, you know, I work out regularly to stay in shape and stay active. And it's the same thing with being an inclusive leader. It's not something you're doing in a box over here on the side and you go to it, you know, once a week or once every 2 weeks. It literally weave it into the culture of what you're doing every day, how you're talking to people, how you're passing people in the hallway, the meetings you have, you know, making sure that you are thinking about everyone in the room, and are they having the opportunity where they feel seen, heard, valued, and understood? We come back to that again in the end of the book, that this concept of belonging is where people really feel connected to each other. They understand their role, their purpose, their connection to the larger goal. And as a leader, you are not only working to achieve the organizational goals, the departmental goals, but you tie in what are the individual needs, what are their goals and aspirations. And so that takes getting to know people at a deeper level and spending time to see them as individuals and all the gifts that they bring. So we talk about diversity as being many different dimensions, both visible dimensions and invisible. And the leader's role is to really dive deep and to get to know those folks. What are those invisible dimensions? What are the other aspects of them that you don't know about? And then to mine those for the gifts that they bring, not only you as a leader, but your teammates and the organization as a whole. And this is done throughout the employee life cycle. And so the book is set up as a guide. And we were very intentional about calling it a guide, like a bird guidebook, you know, like for birders. Like you literally have the book on your desk with it tabbed and dog-eared to each chapter, depending on what you're doing at that particular time at work. You can go to that chapter and open it up and say, oh, I'm doing recruiting, or I'm doing people talent development, or I'm in a promotion cycle or recruiting. You know, you can get daily practices. And I'm gonna stop and Eddie's gonna probably share some really, you know, really good gems that are the daily practices that we talk about.
Thanks, Jonathan. Eddie, again, I'll step back a little bit though and just talk a little bit more, if you don't mind, Kevin. I think you were asking too about how do we see leaders and leadership and define and think about leaders. Was that part of the question?
Yeah. Initially, I guess what I was thinking is the whole check the box thing, which I think is kind of a mentality that I know I run into in DEIB anyway. It's that, okay, you know, quick, give me this quick little, you know, 2-hour workshop, or let me go to this webinar or whatever. But I'm also thinking that a person has to have a certain attitude toward leadership. And how do you take maybe that reluctant leader who says, oh, you know, I'm tired of reading all these books and going all these diversity things, you know, right, here's another right. book I got to read.
Right. No, understand. I just want to make sure I stay within the confines of your comments. And I'll build on what Jonathan, I think, really nicely described. And I think what I would add to what he said is what we tried to do in the book is make sure that those reluctant leaders, those leaders who feel like they have just so much they have to accomplish and do, and they don't have time to add an overwhelming amount of work to their plates in order to drive diversity, in order to lead inclusively, in order to be an inclusive leader. How can we get them on board? How can we make them understand that, no, actually, you don't have to get 3 big old things that you have to do in order to drive diversity. Actually, if you take one action, one activity, one behavior change, one comment you make, and drop that pebble that causes a ripple, it is that single action that actually starts the process of change. And what we talk about in the book, too, and what we encourage leaders to understand is you drop that pebble and you cause a ripple. That other ripple that you cause will cause someone else to drop a pebble, which causes a ripple, which causes someone else to drop a pebble, which causes a ripple. And it's the aggregation of all those pebbles or little wins or activities that actually leads to systemic and cultural change. Literally, things change over time in a way that's sustainable when you don't try to do this one big activity, you know, quarterly, but that you do things on a daily basis. And that's what we get across to leaders. And we tell leaders, look, that's as simple as in a meeting, for example, you hear a woman who is, and women are often cut off in middle of conversations or spoke over much more often than men. If you have a male leader in a room and says, wait, hold on a second, Kevin, let's listen to what Mary has to say. I want your points is important, but let's hear Mary because she got cut off and what she has to contribute is super valuable. In that very statement, that is a pebble that you've just dropped. one, you've provided an educational situation where you made it clear that women shouldn't be cut off in the meeting in a way that calls the person in, not out. So you don't create defensiveness. You're actually saying, oh, sorry. And you just give the person an opportunity to do this. And now Mary in her mind is saying, wow, that's inclusive leadership. That's someone who values my voice, that values what I have to say. And those are some of the elements that you begin building that leads to a culture of belonging. And that culture of belonging doesn't happen if you don't have that pebble that's dropped in that moment. So here's the beauty of the pebble and the ripple. Jonathan may be in that same meeting, and the next meeting he goes to, he hears Tamika being cut off. And now Jonathan has just seen a model behavior, what inclusive leadership looks like and how to lead inclusively. And maybe Jonathan stops Frank from cutting off Tamika in a meeting in the same way, because he just saw that and he dropped a pebble. And so then hopefully other people see that. And so for all the meetings going forward, you have people dropping pebbles. And so for us, that's what inclusive leadership looks like. It doesn't look like this massive, unyielding, unwieldy kind of activity that goes on. It is literally can be done by dropping pebbles on a day-to-day basis. And then the other piece that I'll say, that the other analogy that we use, and we borrow those very liberally from Deborah Meyerson in her notion of the tempered radical book, The Tempered Radical, and is this whole notion of we also encourage leaders to rock the boat and rock it hard, but keep themselves and others in the boat, because that's how you affect change. So it's this combination of that kind of mentality of rocking boats and dropping pebbles that we argue in our book, and that we provide multiple daily practices that are those pebbles across the life cycle of the employee that create those ripples of change. And that is a real core essence of the second half of our book, right, is what we talk about. And this is where we get to that question of what you're talking about. How do you win over this reluctant leader? Well, you show them that this doesn't have to be hard work, but you just need to be willing to be vulnerable. You need to be willing to be caring. You need to be willing to listen and create speak up cultures, humble. But you also, to Jonathan's point earlier, you need to create some wisdom and some knowledge base and have some of the courage to actually lead inclusively. And our book is a guide for all of that.
Well, I love the idea of belonging, because when I started in this work, there was only the D, and then they started
right.
adding
same,
letters.
Same.
yeah, exactly. So we're all in the same boat here. But mm-hmm. I think that what I've run into is that, when people get to the I and they go, well, I'm inclusive. I invited Jonathan and Tamika to the meeting. But then if you're cutting them off, then they're not going right. to feel like they belong. You've got to take that extra step. And then I'm also thinking that, you mentioned over the lifespan of an employee, if that employee leaves, that employee can then take that new renewed sense of, I don't know, self-esteem, looking at themselves as a leader, and that ripple effect continues even mm-hmm. after the employee mm-hmm. has left as well. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the current, what do you think of the current climate of I don't know, the DEIB climate, and what I'm referring to is in 2020, when George Floyd got murdered, there was this huge, like, I don't know what you want to call it, volcanic eruption of right. organizations and businesses calling every single trainer, consultant that was they could find to come in and do trainings on implicit bias and how to have the difficult conversations and microaggressions and all this stuff. And then it seems like it's kind of died down. And now we're dealing with, especially in certain places of the country, this massive pushback, programs being eliminated and, books being banned. And it's like this war is going on right now. So, well, first of all, how do you both feel about that? And then also, given the fact that that's a reality, what's the best way to confront it? So I'll start with you, Eddie, and then we'll go to Jonathan.
Oh, okay. Start with me this time. All right. Thank you. So look, Kevin. Do we have another 2 hours?
well, we can have part two and part three and part four.
we may need to. So, look, I think it's happening for a number of reasons, and my understanding and how, and I've had lots of conversations. So as I know, Jonathan has as well. And we've also spoken about this, obviously, in the context of our book and all that. I just think what you're seeing now currently is this, as you said, pushback. I see it more as a backlash and more of an attack on the four principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or ID&E, as we say it, because historically what you've seen over the years in cyclical periods, whenever you see underestimated groups begin making gains and begin having more success and more equity in society, you often see this backlash, and oftentimes it's violence. If you think about some of the violent times in our history, where whole, well-built Black communities are attacked and burned down and destroyed because they have banks and housing and people are prospering and doing this, is because there's this fear of replacement. There's this fear of it being a zero-sum game. And if they're very specifically are gaining, we're losing. As opposed to seeing this as not a zero-sum game, that actually the beauty of diversity, inclusion, equity, everything we talk about, is the pie gets bigger and we prosper more, we're more innovative and creative. But I think people get blinded to in-group, out-group dynamics, the fear of losing what they own, the fear of their privilege and power going away. And so you have that kind of atmosphere, and then in the current climate that we're in, you also then have a situation where it just happened to be politically at the same time. And hopefully we can get a little political down in here. I think you have to in this, right? Yeah. Is then you have this juxtaposition of rhetoric and belief and politicians who saw advantage of preying on this divisive fear that people had, and they, I think, really effectively have really made people afraid and have really made the other in a big way, right? Whether you're immigrants or LGBTQ or the Jewish community or Black, Brown, communities, whatever. And this is what we're facing. And so the fallout that we're seeing now, this attack we're seeing now, actually is one step far. There's the next piece in the puzzle leading to this experience that we're having as ID&E professionals, is when the affirmative action was overturned for higher ed by the Supreme Court, because what that did now is embolden people to challenge what they see again as disadvantaged as being created to them when there isn't any. And so they've preyed on this idea that, okay, we're at the point where we don't need any more affirmative action, accommodation, anything, because we're all, it's an equal playing field. There is no racism right now. You hear current politicians on one side saying, we've never been a racist society and we still aren't. So people are preying on those moments to now say, if the Supreme Court has said higher ed can no longer use affirmative action, why should there be affirmative action programs in what loans are given out, in the kinds of education that we do in our schools and so on and so on. So I think that, to me, that gives you at least my two cents on why we see ourselves where we are. It's cyclical. It is something we see all the time, but it's also opportunistic, and it's also being fed by people who are willing to use that rhetoric to maintain and hold on to their own power. And unfortunately, people like Jonathan and I and you who do this work are now having to work even harder to convince people that, no, we aren't creating advantage or disadvantage for others. Actually, step away from that. We are creating capability and creativity and innovation for for moving forward. And that's how you should think about inclusion, diversity, and equity. Everyone benefits, and white's not neutral, right? You know, so I'll stop and I'll let Jonathan weigh in. And this is such a powerful topic, Kevin. I'm glad you brought it up. Jonathan?
Oh, yeah, no problem.
What else would you add?
Yeah, I think I'll just fill in a little bit that because I think you did an awesome job of describing the what's going on right now in society. And actually, Kevin, I just wrote a blog that I'm going to release. It's actually on the inclusivepebbles.com website under blog right now. Mm-hmm. That the title is How Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity Benefits White Men and Everyone Else Too. And that's the exact topic of the blogs, which is right to your question. So what I talk about in the blog is a lot of what Eddie described, but also that, like, I think that we're in, so there's this idea of that there's a lot of misinformation out there about what inclusion, diversity, and equity is, what its purpose is, what its goals are, and that narrative has been hijacked. And it's been hijacked in a way to describe that if you win, meaning people that have historically been underestimated, oppressed, marginalized, then I lose as a white male. Let's just call a duck a duck. And that just isn't the case. And it's not the case because we know that diverse teams outperform homogeneous teams over time. It's been shown in studies going back to the 50s. And white men benefit too, because we're dealing with some of the most complex, difficult problems. Think about AI and all the ramifications of AI. We and how business is now global. We need diverse teams. We need teams with white men, but not just based on race and color. We need Canadians. We need people from Europe. We need people from all different, you know, diverse dimensions of diversity, right? And we need to have their perspective and experiences and knowledge and their differences at the table. And they need to be heard, to your point about belonging, so we can surface those ideas and opinions. And it's not necessarily that someone's going to be right, but they might trigger somebody else to have an idea based on what they said that gets us to what's right, because we're dealing with these adaptive learning problems where no one person has the answer. So it takes this diversity of perspectives to get us to what is the proper or right way to go in these complex times. So, and who we know that, you know, and I was just looking at, in fact, I quoted in the blog, is that there was a study done recently that still shows, and I say still because it showed it in prior studies, that the dominant culture is still in the US, particularly in Western countries, white and male. And so if you're building diverse teams that are successful, that are high performing and effective, and you're the leader of that team in a high percentage of the scenarios, you are going to benefit. You're going to get that promotion. You're going to get that raise. You're going to get that new job, because it's your team that was high performing and successful. And you're going to benefit from that diversity of people that are helping you solve the problems for your team and your organization. So white men benefit too. And remember, white men aren't just white men. I am a 64-year-old Canadian Jewish kid, you know, who has a heterosexual partner. I've got two adult children, daughters that I've raised. I'm a runner. I love photography. I love hiking. I love, you know, I mean, where I'm getting at is, and I believe in social justice, there are all these dimensions of me that go beyond my race and gender. And so, like Eddie said, white is not neutral. White, we bring, there's more to just race and gender for what we bring, right? That perspective. And certainly with what's happening in the world today with Jewish folks, that I have a much greater empathy for Black and brown people and gay people and people with disabilities who've gone through this world and with oppression and marginalization. That empathy has grown over the last few years in a way that I never, you know, had seen in my life before. So the other problem we have that's not helping us is that to do diversity work, you don't need to be licensed. You don't need a particular degree. You can read a few books. You can be passionate about the subject, and you can get out there and do the work. And you may be doing it with an agenda. You may be doing it. And there's a lot of great practitioners and great professionals in this space. But we have a problem also with not having a discipline that is managed in a way that has a level of certification to do the work. And so there can be malpractice where people are not doing diversity with the goals of everybody benefiting. And I think that has not been talked about enough.
And I think that's a challenge that we have, because we can be our own worst enemy when we have folks out there that aren't applying the work. Like, a lot of people just talk about unconscious bias. And this is one of the things we talk about in our book, is that it's much more than just unconscious bias. There's a lot more to it. And this is the 7 insights of inclusive leadership that we've been working on and Eddie's developed over many, many years. So that's kind of some different ways to kind of think about it. And we need to land that that conversation, bring that narrative back home again.
And if you don't mind, Kevin, if I jump in, Jonathan just, you know, sparked something in my head too, which
I saw the sparks flying. Like, right,
yeah, and it was
not happening
exactly, because I love the angle he took on the last part of his response, in that I think he called it malpractice, which I think is fair. I think in a lot of situations people will assume, and this is what my ad, I think in a lot of situations people will assume, simply because you're part of the HR organization, you automatically understand how to do ID&E work. Right. That if you're an HR person, you must understand, you know, what intersectionality is and how to think about that in data. Right. And you don't. And one of the things we talk about in our book is in something that I've been talking about, and Jonathan, both of us have been talking about for years, is how do you make HR true diversity and inclusion and equity partners? And oftentimes it is tweaking trainings to make sure they understand what their part is, to make sure their customers, who are the employees, the leaders, the people who are in the company, they understand. So they need to understand not only what the topic is, but how do I get that topic across to those leaders who I represent? So we talk about, you know, HR's true diversity partners and the kinds of things that you have to do in order to help facilitate and the whole notion and principle behind inclusion, diversity, and equity, which is creativity and innovation and growth and global awareness, right? So that's the piece that I thought's worth saying in tying it back to our book, is we very specifically talk about HR as true diversity partners, which is a really important piece of it. I just wanted to make sure that I got that piece out, and we were able to talk a little bit about that. And then the we keep mentioning the 2IL model, the insights of inclusive leadership, and I'll give you just a very quick summation of it, because it is a core piece and foundational piece from the first half of the book, along with what Jonathan was talking about when we think about wisdom, courage, and heart being these platforms and expectations that we have for inclusive leaders. Wrapping that around is this 2IL model, which you should think about them as insights that every leader or person who wants to be an inclusive leader. And as we talk about, inclusive leadership is just leadership, right? So if you want to be a leader, we think you need to understand cultural competence. You need to understand how ethnocentrism drives your behavior, and ethnocentrism simply being how we judge others using our culture and background and experiences as the standard, right? And we talk about unconscious biases, Jonathan's talked about, which, to iterate what he said again, is people jump into unconscious bias and that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying, the point we're trying to make, is that's one piece of the puzzle that you should do, right? The other piece is you need to understand how stereotyping happens and how stereotypes exist within our brains. And actually, because they're a way to think about them is just oversimplifying situations so that we can effectively understand how to navigate through them. That's stereotyping, right? And so we all do it, right? And so then we talk about micro inequities and microaggressions, and we have to understand how we play in that part as well. We talk about the platinum rule, which is you know, treating people how they want to be treated. So inclusive leaders need to understand, don't treat people how you want to be treated. Don't coach people how you like to. Don't give feedback how you like to receive it. You know, don't always train and do stuff the way you think you want to do it. You actually need to think about who your audience is, who the individual you're talking to, and treat them how they want to be treated. It's an amazing shift in how inclusive leaders lead. And then we talk about the tempered radical perspective, rocking boats and dropping pebbles. And so that's kind of the 7 insights model that we use. And they're all, most of these things we talk about are based on social psychological perspectives that that I gained in my doctoral program at University of Washington, where I got my PhD in sociology and social psychology was part of it. And literally from day one, September 2000, when I stepped in as a diversity manager for Charles Stevens at Microsoft, I introduced the social psychological perspectives because that's how interaction happens. One-to-one, one-to-few, one-to-many, many-to-many, it's through social psychological perspectives like the ones we're talking about. And those fuel and drive them. And you need to understand them, I think, from a leadership perspective, because that guides how you engage with people. That guides you how you decide what information you hear and listen to, you know, what you disagree with, all that. And that is the core of the first half of the book. And it was super fun to write and tie into those daily practices. So that, I know we've mentioned the 2IL model several times, so I thought I would just give at least that piece of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And this is the part where you give out the website, you repeat the name of the book, the website. And by the way, if people go to the website, I mean, you mentioned the blog, Jonathan. What are some of the features of the website? I mean, it sounds like a place that people can go on a regular basis to be fed, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that we did was, first of all, in the book itself, Eddie's son, Arthur, came up with a great idea. Really, he's our innovation advisor, and he came up with the idea of using QR codes in the book. And it was brilliant because this enabled us to go deeper on a topic with a video. So if you're reading a part of the book and you want to go deeper on the topic, you hit the QR, scan the QR code with your phone. It'll take you to a video on our website for the book, Inclusive Pebbles, and you'll be able to watch the video of us talking about it, about that part of the book. The second thing is there's resources that we reference throughout the book that also are in the back with a QR code. So what's great about that is as those evolve and change, we can add new resources or take away ones that are outdated because it's on the website. So you hit the QR code from the back of the book for resources and boom, it takes you to the resource page on our website. The other thing is there's a host of videos we mentioned that we use in our training. And we've put those all up on the website as well. And you can watch those now and they link to YouTube videos that we have. And then of course, all these great resources that if somebody else has ambitions about writing a book on this topic or others, they can look at the great people that helped us at Barrett Kohler, the photographer, the videographer, or the publicist, all those names are out there as well. And so you can, you know, obviously reach out to us. There's our individual business websites that you can reach in out to that link to us or even email us through the about John, about the author's page, about Eddie, about Jonathan. So it's a fun site. And even the developer is located in India, great guy that we both work with to develop our business website. So it's, you know, global in that respect. And it's really fun to release it, actually launched it today.
Today. So just reiterate, so www.inclusivepebbles.com, and that will get you to it. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
You have been listening to an interview with Eddie Pate and Jonathan Stutz talking about their essential new book on leadership called Daily Practices of Inclusive Leaders. This has been All the Way Authentic. I'm your host, Kevin P. Henry.